folks. You're listening to the Mad Dog, Matt Wilson, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Dave King and Frank Tortaglioni of Philmont, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here.
Zara Tapton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. The Catskill Town Board has adopted a $6.98 million town budget for 2020. The spending reflects a 2.8% increase in spending and a tax rate of $6.35 per $1,000 of value. Town Supervisor Doreen Davis said the initial tentative budget, as presented in October, was a compilation of wish lists from departments. The tentative budget called for a 3.9% tax increase, and the town board was then tasked with reducing the projected increase to an amount that fell under the state tax cap. With the exception of 2019, the board has delivered the budget below the state-mandated tax cap for three of the last 4 years, Davis said, citing sewer costs for the increased budget last year. On the revenue side, there has been an increase of 1.4% as the result of additional business permit activity related to economic development, Davis said. Building permits increased from more than $32,000 in September 2018 to $82,591 in September 2019, she said. The budget includes health care increases for employees, modest salary increases, and an investment in the ambulance service. Davis said, and I quote, "We put aside funding to supplement a comprehensive plan review and to fund costs incurred as a result of legal action taken against the town." The board chose to draw $370,000 from the town's fund balance to stay under the cap, she said. Davis noted that despite advertising a total of three budget workshops and public hearings, the board did not receive much public input on the plan. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com.
Amelia Teasdale reports in the Columbia paper that at the November 7th Town of Chatham meeting, 2 days after the election, newly elected Town Supervisor Donal Collins and Town Board Member-elect Abby Messick both urged the Town Board to put aside the zoning proposal until the new board takes office in January. Collins also asked the board for the money, for more money for legal consultations in the budget. He said he is anticipating more legal costs around zoning issues. The zoning proposal in the Town of Chatham had been before a couple of public hearings in conflict with state law and was being reviewed by the County Planning Board last month. Read more about this story in the Columbia paper.
Chris McKenna is reporting for The Fray. U.S. Representatives Antonio Delgado and Sean Patrick Maloney are among 37 House Democrats this week targeted in digital ads by conservative groups opposed to the impeachment of President Donald Trump. The American Action Network spent $2 million on the spots, urging the House member to, and I quote, work on issues we care about, end quote, and dismissing the inquiry as a, and I quote, a partisan charade, end quote. Release of the ads coincided with the start of the televised impeachment hearings on November 13th and provide like-minded readers with a link to their representatives. The targets are Democrats whose congressional districts Trump won in 2016. Maloney, who represents New York's 18th district, told supporters in a fundraising email this week that he was, and I quote, already facing an onslaught of Republican attacks for standing up for our democracy, end quote, and that, and I quote, Republicans are spending in my district to stop us from getting to the truth, end quote. You can read the full story at The Fray.
Mark Singleis reports in the Times Union that minor league baseball appears to be staying in the Hudson Valley if reports are true. Major League Baseball is proposing major changes in minor league baseball, mostly shrinking the number of teams and players. There are reports out this week that both the Hudson Valley Renegades in Dutchess County and the Tri-City Valley Cats in Troy will still be teams after the 2020 season, when the league may reduce the current number of 160 affiliated minor league teams by about 25%. Valley Cats are currently affiliates of the Houston Astros, and the Renegades are affiliates with the Tampa Bay Rays. Both are now in the New York Penn League as the Class A short season, but with reorganization would be playing full seasons. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
The office of Columbia County Clerk Holly Tanner has announced the KISS program will be available to seniors from December 2nd through December 13th. The program provides older residents the opportunity to shred sensitive documents free of charge by dropping the materials off at local town halls. Keeping the Identities of Seniors Safe, or KISS, program was founded by Tanner 6 years ago. Seniors bring their sensitive materials, such as old credit card receipts, bank statements, and tax records, to their local town hall, where they are placed in a locked 64-gallon container. The container is securely stashed until certified document security removes the container and brings it to their facility in New Lebanon for shredding. All 18 towns located in Columbia County participate in the program. Anyone interested is directed to contact their local town hall for hours of operation and more information. Editors note, Tanner is an active WGXC volunteer programmer.
Kayla Harris reports in the Times Union that at least two Hudson Valley congressional representatives and one candidate have seen a higher national profile since impeachment hearings began last week. Democrat Sean Patrick Maloney, who represents the 18th District in the southern Hudson Valley, and Republican Elise Stefanik, who represents the 21st District north of Albany, are on the Intelligence Committee asking questions during the hearings that are being broadcast on WGXC. Stefanik was involved in a stunt November 15th where she demanded time to talk that was reserved for the chairs or counsel. She has added over 150,000 Twitter followers since the hearings began, but her opponent, Democrat Tedra Cobb, has added over 190,000 and says she has raised over $1 million in campaign contributions in 3 days. Stefanik is not saying how much she has raised, but her office tweeted links to her fundraising page 8 times last week. Stefanik beat Cobb, a former two-term St. Lawrence County legislator, in the 2018 election. Maloney has not been involved in any controversy with his questions so far and has been making himself available regularly on CNN and MSNBC. Representatives Antonio Delgado and Paul Tonko, both Democrats, are not going out of their way to discuss the impeachment proceedings. Delgado was asked about it at a town hall meeting November 16th in Copake, broadcast on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Okay, let's get all of the truth out. Let's investigate the Bidens.
Oh, my God. Oh.
Let's investigate Hillary Clinton. Hold on. Let's investigate Hillary Clinton's email scandals. Let's investigate.
Wait. Come on now. Calm down. Go ahead, sir.
That's it. Let's investigate the whole thing.
Yeah, what's your question? You're supposed to have a question.
When are we going to investigate them?
So I would just say, first I just want to say this: we gotta be respectful. Yeah. You know, people have different points of views. It happens in democracy. Particularly for my progressive friends, we really take pride in our diversity. Diversity is also political points of view. There will be different points of view. Everybody has different walks of life, different experiences, and it's up to us to figure out how to hear each other out. We disagree. There actually has been an investigation. They just closed the books on the investigation into Hillary Clinton. They just closed the books, and they just made the findings. And there were no corruption.
Read more about this story in the Times Union.
Robert Galvin is reporting for the Times Union. New York State Inspector General Letizia Tagliaferro, November 14th, released the results of her office's investigation of Robert Freeman, the former executive director of the State Committee on Open Government. That investigation found that Freeman, and I quote, subjected at least 14 women to sexual harassment or inappropriate conduct dating back to at least 2003 in an egregious pattern of lechery, end quote, that stopped only after a target of that harassment told investigators Freeman had subjected her to unwanted physical contact. Freeman, 72, an attorney, was fired by the Department of State in June after serving in state government since 1974. He was a longtime resource for news reporters and an acknowledged expert on the state's freedom of information law. The report released Thursday revealed a pattern of conduct in which Freeman crossed the line with women he subjected to unwanted kissing and touching, leers, and inappropriate conversations. The report stated, and I quote, given the stature Freeman attained during his tenure as executive director, his role as the sole authority on government transparency, and the power dynamic he repeatedly promoted, many of the women who spoke with the inspector general said they believed it would be futile to report his misconduct, end quote. The report said Freeman was also found to have sexually explicit images of women on his work computer. It noted that twice a year, the software on his work computer would need to be reinstalled because of virus and malicious software. The report criticized the State Office of Information Technology Services, which is responsible for the Committee on Open Government's computer systems. Read the full story in the Times Union.
The New York City Department of Environmental Protection announced November 15th that it has opened 2,956 additional acres of water supply land to outdoor enthusiasts for recreation and hunting. The areas include places in Delaware, Dutchess, Greene, Putnam, Schoharie, Sullivan, Ulster, and Westchester counties. Quote, DEP has long understood that many types of recreation are compatible with our core mission to protect the water supply for millions of New Yorkers, unquote, DEP Commissioner Vincent Sapienza said. Quote, our neighbors who participate in hunting season are important to the ecological health of our watershed, and we welcome them to make safe and productive use of the water supply lands that we've opened for hunting in the Catskills and Hudson Valley, unquote. Hunting season opened in the Catskills November 16th.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day.
National Weather Service in Albany predicts Monday there's a chance of freezing rain and sleet in the morning, then turning to rain and sleet, then perhaps turning to snow at night. 60% chance of precipitation on Monday with a high near 38. Monday night, the prediction is for maybe 1 to 2 inches of snow, maybe sleet. Starting as rain, changing to snow and sleet over the course of the evening with a low around 32. Tuesday again, snow is likely in the morning, then it changes to rain in the afternoon with a high near 42. Tuesday night should be mostly cloudy with a low around 29. Wednesday should be mostly cloudy with a high of 42 and a low around 29. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, radio for open ears. There are so many extra web streams at WGXC and wavefarm.org this week. Go to wavefarm.org/listen at any time to find all sorts of web stream from the live microphones at the bottom of the Wave Farm pond and microphones out in the forest at Wave Farm to performances and town meetings all over the area. Monday and Tuesday, the city of Hudson has a public hearing on its budget on Monday at 6 p.m., and then a special meeting about that budget at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, November 19th, followed by its regular City of Hudson town meeting at 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 19th. Wednesday, November 20th, the town of Catskill has its town meeting, and you can hear that at wavefarm.org/listen at 6:30 p.m. Thursday, November 21st, there's two live performances Thursday night at 8 p.m. First, from New York City, live from the Fridman Gallery, Leah Bertucci performs with Amirtha Kadimibia, her Phase Eclipse record release. That's at 8 p.m. live from the Fridman Gallery in New York City. Then, also at 8 p.m. live from the Avalon Lounge in Catskill, Party of the Sun performs. Also, Lady Jane and Catskill's Alex Pede Wernquist opens the show Thursday, November 21st. Two shows you can listen to online at wgxc.org. Friday, November 22nd, another show from the Avalon Lounge. This time, Bunny Brains performs at 9 p.m. Friday, November 22nd, featuring Dan Seward, who hosts the Battlefield Earth Show Tuesday nights at 10 p.m. on WGXC. Saturday, November 23rd, another show at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill. Bill Lee, Jeff Beam, and PJ Gray DJs later at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill. Saturday, November 23rd, starting at 8:30 p.m. on the radio at 90.7 FM, WGXC.org.
Get a local event mentioned on All Together Now. Go to WGXC.org and click on Add an Event at the top of the page. And copy and paste the information about your event in the boxes. Let's all get involved in our community. See what's going on at WGXC.org in the community calendar.
On Monday, November 18th, Mobile Office Hours provide the opportunity for constituents to meet with U.S. Representative Antonio Delgado's staff for assistance with constituent services. The congressman's staff will be available as follows: 8 to 10 a.m. at Fulton Town Hall, West Fulton in Schoharie County, and 12 to 2 p.m. at the Canajoharie Village Office in Canajoharie in Montgomery County.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Wendy Schmaltz of Claverick, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa. Former Vice President Joe Biden skipped his third major California Democratic Party event this weekend. His absence gave another chance for frontrunners to emerge. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was well-received by the state party's liberal base, according to the Associated Press. But former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, not so much. He criticized some of the more popular Democratic candidates the day he announced he's running.
I think that if we want solutions that last, they can't be solutions that feel to the voting public as if they are just Democratic solutions.
Former President Barack Obama joined the primary conversation, advising Democratic hopefuls about health care and immigration specifically, that most Americans don't want to, quote, tear down the system. Some contenders pushed back. Sanders said he's fighting for justice, not tearing down the system. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker cautioned, quote, whoever is the nominee, we have one shot to make Donald Trump a one-term president, unquote. And he wants people to, quote, stop drawing artificial lines. Patrick agrees with most other candidates that politics has to change. But he's running because, he says, some plans are too bold.
Misses the moment. Because, you know, the one truth, in my opinion, that candidate Trump spoke in 2016 was when he said that conventional or establishment politics isn't working well enough for most people.
Entrepreneur Andrew Yang, once thought of as a long-shot candidate, is now consistently among the top six in national polling, though he's still close to 20 points behind the frontrunners.
I am the candidate that's best positioned to beat Donald Trump in the general election. The voters here in New Hampshire are realizing that. That's one reason my poll numbers are rising. And Democrats in Iowa and around the country are realizing it as well.
In Iowa, though, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg soared ahead of the pack for the first time last week, polling at 22 and 25% in the most recent surveys. In Saturday's Des Moines Register CNN Seltzer poll, Elizabeth Warren was at 16% and Biden and Sanders tied at 15%. Polls turned out to be accurate in the Louisiana governor's race this weekend, where incumbent Democrat John Bel Edwards won with a narrow lead, despite President Trump campaigning for Edwards' opponent, Republican Eddie Rasponi, with inflammatory rhetoric that did not achieve his goal.
Your vote on Saturday is your chance to show the radical left Washington Democrats that Louisiana rejects their extremism.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar referenced the recent Kentucky governor's race as well, where a Trump-backed incumbent Republican lost to a Democratic challenger, tweeting, quote, second governor's race in 2 weeks in red state where Trump campaigned, and a Dem won. Where else can we send him? From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke, and Chris Anderson worked on this episode. Thanks to Kevin Bowe for Deval Patrick's New Hampshire interview, and thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
In the wake of Governor Cuomo's blistering letter of November 12th to National Grid, which was in reaction to the utility's extortion-like tactics of denial of service to more than 1,100 downstate gas customers, one might have thought Thursday's Public Service Commission meeting would be, well, newsworthy. Not so much. The recent trend of the Renewable Heat Now Coalition, a group of concerned citizens and environmental organizations attending the PSC meetings, continued, however. They recognize that the PSC has an enormous amount of power to reduce the use of methane, one of the most potent greenhouse gases, and that time is running out. After the PSC meeting, the group delivered a letter to Governor Cuomo thanking him for his recent action, but also calling on the governor and the PSC to meet their legal obligations of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act to establish and implement a plan to reduce and eliminate greenhouse gas emissions and create a sustainable future. Here's Lee Zishi of Sane Energy Project speaking at a press conference after delivering the letter to the governor.
This is the third month in a row that the Renewable Heat Now Coalition has come to the monthly public service meeting. It is the third month in a row that they have punted on releasing their energy efficiency order. And, you know, every month our message is the same. It's we need to get off of gas and you need to give us that path and that plan to do it. And every month, as time gets less and less to act on climate change, they continue to only take small incremental steps and kick the big decisions down the road. Earlier this week, Governor Cuomo began to seem like he's really starting to listen to the people of New York. He sent a letter to National Grid letting them know of his decision to begin to revoke their license for using moratorium scare tactics to push for a fracked gas pipeline, the Williams pipeline. So we are very heartened to see Governor Cuomo begin to finally listen to the people. But we have to also recognize that we wouldn't be in this position of being beholden to National Grid's bullying tactics if New York State's Public Service Commission and Governor Cuomo were doing their jobs and listening to the climate science and getting us off of gas. Right now in New York City, St. Energy Project is a party in both the Con Ed and National Grid rate cases. Both of these corporate utilities want to spend hundreds of millions of dollars every single year, our ratepayer dollars, that money that we work so hard for. They want to spend that extending the life of frack gas infrastructure and expanding pipelines. We know that that goes completely against climate science. That also goes against the CLCPA that's been recently passed, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. So right now, the only plan guiding us forward for the next couple years is the utilities plan. And we know that they only make their money if they continue to invest in gas. Their plans go completely against climate science. They're ignoring all of this and just patting themselves on the back for making small incremental changes. But we know that we only have 11 years to dramatically reduce our fossil fuel use and our emissions. And to continue down the wrong path, spending our money going in the wrong direction, is just insane. So we will continue to come to these Public Service Commission meetings. We will continue to hold their feet to the fire. But every time we come here, the urgency is getting more and more strong. So Governor Cuomo, John Rhodes, the Public Service Commission, we don't want to come here anymore. This is not an easy thing to do. So please do your jobs.
After Lee Zishi spoke, a representative of Senator Julia Salazar voiced the senator's support for getting off of fossil fuels. Andrew Pizzullo of Food and Water Action was next.
I don't have too much to say. Coming out of the meeting today, I'm a little disappointed. I had this date on my calendar for an energy efficiency order day. I was really excited to drive home to Kingston today with some new information about rebates on heat pumps. That has not happened. I'm hoping that it happens in December. I know there are a lot of other things on the agenda, including rate cases where we're primarily looking at ratepayer money going to utilities to fund continued gas infrastructure, which at this juncture seems absolutely bizarre and crazy to me. But I want to speak specifically about Governor Cuomo's blistering response to National Grid's incompetence. And to me, it's really welcome news. I'm going to quote really briefly from the governor's letter to National Grid. Governor Cuomo wrote about National Grid's shameless scare tactics. They said the moratorium is either a fabricated device or a lack of competence. There is no legitimate need for it in the first place. National Grid should have explored all other options before denying service. Electric service demand response measures could be proposed. Heat pumps and renewable sources could be proposed. Governor Cuomo goes on to say, there are only two theories to explain National Grid's action. Either National Grid was grossly negligent in relying exclusively on the speculative construction of a private pipeline to meet demands that it's statutorily required to provide. Those are pretty strong words and pretty true words. Or National Grid deliberately defrauded the people of the state by not developing or pursuing existing supply options to further their business interests at the cost of the ratepayer. So to us at Food and Water Action, Food and Water Watch, this is a seriously satisfying piece of rhetoric. And it's grade A political theater. Affected communities, business owners, renters, NYSHA residents should feel vindicated in part by the strong language coming from the governor's office. But to take this rhetoric and to turn it into durable action, into climate solutions that make material impacts in New Yorkers' lives and policy that takes our climate crisis seriously, New York needs a plan.
Ruth Foster of Stop New York Fracked Gas Pipeline spoke next.
Hi, I'm Ruth Foster, and I'm with a group called Stop New York Fracked Gas Pipeline. And we named it that because in 2014, we were fighting a pipeline that was going through Rensselaer and Albany counties, and it started in the fracking fields of Pennsylvania and would have gone, if built, all the way to Massachusetts for over 400 miles. Luckily, Kinder Morgan withdrew that application and that pipeline was stopped. And since then, we have been doing educational events about climate and how pipelines and frack gas creates climate destruction. We are having a renewable energy fair this Saturday, so we hope everybody can come. But anyway, so in April, we found out that they were going to put another pipeline through. But this is a different one because it's a local pipeline. And our last pipeline, we had to fight FERC, which is a federal agency. This pipeline, apparently because it's just 7 miles, is under the control of the Public Service Commission. When we went to the Public Service Commission hearing about public listening session.
Hi there, this is Freddie Johnston, and you're listening to WGXC in Accra.
The Spanish production duo LCC explored an arc of sonic tension between mining machinery and the wilderness for their Devolution album, and we'll hear a gem on the next Deep Threes. Plus music from Estefest, the Checco Fornarelli Trio, and Corey Wallace. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Becca Van Kay of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, November 18th, 2019. I'm Dan Hyman. After coming under criticism for attacking a witness during impeachment testimony, President Donald Trump is now lashing out at a State Department employee and advisor to Vice President Pence, who is set to testify. Career Foreign Service Officer Jennifer Williams is expected to repeat closed-door testimony about Trump's discussions with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, which she called unusual and inappropriate. Trump has called her a long-time never-Trumper. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi says Trump can testify to the committee either in person or in writing if he wants. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Trump should appear. As Schumer puts it, he shouldn't tweet. He should come to the committee and testify under oath. The White House seems unlikely to accept the invitation. One witness who is scheduled this week is EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland. He may say in public under oath that Trump directed him to get dirt on Joe and Hunter Biden and to withhold aid to Ukraine until it was forthcoming. Police in Hong Kong are threatening to use live ammunition as demonstrators at a university campus countered water cannons and stinging chemical sprays with Molotov cocktails. In what some read as a threatening signal, Chinese army troops left their barracks last week for the first time, but so far have only removed improvised barriers to traffic. Around this country, some utilities are pushing to protect their profitability as more people get electricity from rooftop solar. Some want to charge more for maintaining the grid. Others want to cut what they pay when folks feed excess power when their meters run backwards under what's known as net metering. One solar group estimates a proposal by the Idaho Power Company to no longer pay the regular retail rate for net metered power would turn the investments already made in solar by 1,300 families and small businesses suddenly uneconomic.
The utility wants to cut in half the price it pays for excess electricity sent back to the grid from solar owners. Brianna Kobor with Vote Solar says the change will lead to large bill increases for more than 4,000 customers.
To be frank, traditional power interests are working to stall progress to protect their old way of doing business. Rooftop solar threatens Idaho Power Company's monopoly profits, and they're eager to slow its growth.
Kobor notes technology is making solar cheaper, but this rule change will put it out of reach for many. Idaho Power serves more than 560,000 people in Idaho and Oregon. It has committed to getting 100% of its energy from clean sources by 2045. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
This is PNS. The Centers for Disease Control is warning that the flu looks like it's starting early this year. The CDC says 30 states are already seeing the disease. But the good news is the doctors there say this year's vaccine appears to be a good match for this year's virus. 3.4 million Texans are caregivers to folks who are senior or infirm, often family members. That's a role the caregivers are often thrust into, whether they choose it or not. A new report quantifies the value of their efforts.
According to the AARP, Texas caregivers provided $35 billion worth of unpaid care in 2017. Rose Puente of San Antonio has been a caregiver for both her parents, her aunt, her son, and her husband. She says while it's a rewarding job, caregiving is a highly stressful and sometimes emotional experience.
They all get to a point where they lose patience. And I happen to be the one that kind of gets the brunt of that. But it doesn't take long for them to say, thank you for what you've done. I'm sorry that I did that.
According to the report, 60% are balancing their caregiving duties with a paid job elsewhere. The report notes that increasing demand for caregivers and shrinking families will make caregiving even more difficult in the years to come. There were about 7 potential family caregivers for every person age 80 plus in 2010. By the year 2030, that number could potentially be cut in half. November is Family Caregivers Month. For Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman.
November is also National Diabetes Month, and a new pilot program in East Baltimore is teaching an underserved community heart-healthy cooking as part of a diabetes prevention program.
The Diabetes Prevention Program in Baltimore is based on a model created by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Stephanie Rose, who's teaching the pilot's heart-healthy cooking classes, says she's co-teaching the classes with a life coach. Together, they'll help participants learn about nutrition and how to incorporate economic, good-tasting meals using less salt and fat into their day-to-day lives.
Start with fresh food. If you can't get that, okay, you can use the can, but be conscientious to buy salt-free or low sodium, because sometimes you can't get the fresh tomato. So it's okay to use the can, but get the low sodium.
Studies show that people living with diabetes are 2 times more likely to develop cardiovascular disease and die from it. Nearly half of adults in America have diabetes or pre-diabetes, but many don't have access to healthy resources such as supermarkets or safe places to exercise, which this pilot intends to remedy. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard reporting.
I'm Dan Hyman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Sarah Topton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Green County lawmakers are scheduled to meet Monday, November 18th, to discuss change orders to the new jail facility in Coxsackie and for the planned demolition of the former jail in Catskill. Construction of the 80-cell, 64-bed facility is currently underway off Route 9W in Coxsackie. The new jail will be divided into 3 pods, a pod with 16 beds for women, a pod with 32 beds for men, and an additional 16-bed pod also for men.
Deputy Greene County Administrator Warren Hart also estimates the state environmental quality review for demolition of the old jail will be completed sometime this month. Once the review is finished, the county will need another month to put the project out to bid, Hart said. The jail complex and the sheriff's office are slated for demolition, while the historic carriage house will remain intact. Once the jail building is leveled, the site on Bridge Street in Catskill will be made into a parking lot. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. MidHudsonNews.com is reporting the Dutchess County Sheriff's Office has issued a fraud warning for the residents of Dutchess County and surrounding areas about scams that seem to be on the increase. The most recent scam involves fake warrants. The victim receives a call from a person saying they were law enforcement and advised them there was a warrant out for their arrest. The victim is then told the warrant will be purged if they send money right away. The sheriff's office had several reports of this scam in November. During those calls, the caller identified himself as, and I quote, Sergeant Mark from the Dutchess County Sheriff's Office, end quote. The sheriff's office said it is imperative to refrain from sending any money to an unknown person until the situation described has been confirmed through an independent source. If it is a scam, once the money is sent, it is very difficult and most times impossible to get it back. Anyone who thinks they may have been the victim of a scam are encouraged to contact the sheriff's office at 845-486-3800 or via the tip line at 845-605-CLUE or dcsotips@gmail.com. And you can read the full story at MidHudsonNews.com. Chris McKenna is reporting at the Fray. Governor Andrew M. Cuomo signed a bill November 14th that allows adult adoptees to obtain their original birth certificates with the names of their birth parents. The legislation was more than 25 years in coming. After languishing since 1993, it finally sailed through the Senate and Assembly with little opposition this year. Cuomo said after signing the bill, and I quote, "Where you came from informs who you are, and every New Yorker deserves access to the same birth records. It is a basic human right," end quote. New York had maintained a veil of confidentiality over adoption since the 1930s, allowing adoptees their original birth certificate only in rare instances when a judge consented. Adoptees and their advocates had argued that access to birth records was a basic right that only adoptees had been denied. Read the full story at the Fray. Steve Hughes is reporting for the Times Union. Three organizations have taken legal action over the so-called Boss Bill, a law intended to stop employers from discriminating against employees over reproductive health decisions. The National Institute of Family and Life Advocates, Compass Care Pregnancy Services, and the First Bible Baptist Church of Rochester filed the lawsuit against the state last week. The plaintiffs argue the law is a remedy for a non-existent problem and that its requirements are in conflict with their religious beliefs, thereby violating their civil rights. The plaintiffs allege the bill is, and I quote, "a transparent attempt to meddle in the affairs of religious and pro-life organizations," end quote. The Boss Bill was signed by Governor Andrew Cuomo, and in a statement when the bill was approved in January, the bill's sponsor, Senator Jen Metzger, said it, and I quote, "provides essential protections for women's health and guarantees their fundamental right to make reproductive choices that are best for them and their families," end quote. The measure was first introduced in 2014 in response to the U.S. Supreme Court's Burnwell versus Hobby Lobby Stores decision, which allows some for-profit corporations to be exempt from a regulation its owners object to due to their religious beliefs. And you can read the full story in the Times Union. And that wraps up the WGXE Hands-On Radio Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, visit our website, WGXE.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather. Today starts out in the lower 30s and maxing out at 36 by dark, giving the chance for some icing this morning, especially up in the mountain. Rain moves into the area around 10 a.m. and remains until tomorrow morning, growing in strength overnight. An overnight low of 34 should keep the precipitation just this side of freezing, at least until near dawn, where the rain will fade to less than an inch of snowfall. And this ends just after 9 or so, possibly affecting tomorrow's morning commute. Then temperatures will climb to the low 40s by noon. Tracking the spread of influenza, it appears time to start vigorously washing those hands and get those flu shots. They not only protect you, but they help protect the young, old, and others specifically not able to take one. That being said, Greene and Columbia County are currently free from laboratory-confirmed diseases. However, conditions in surrounding counties and surrounding states have been spiking recently, so it will take effort to keep it that way. Looking way up, we see ourselves in the peak of the Leonid meteor shower. Unfortunately, cloudy conditions will hinder viewing. Otherwise, the shower is visible all night long. Solar wind speed is currently 366 kilometers per second at 6.9 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. There have been 5 days since the last sunspot. This has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Maker Syndicate.
And now here is a preview of the feature shows coming up on WGXC 90.7 FM for Monday, November 18th, 2019. At 11 a.m., The Morning Sampler with Brendan Donegan. In this broadcast, music by Steely Dan, Led Zeppelin, The Rolling Stones, and The Allman Brothers. And then at 12 p.m., Deep Trees, hosted by DeepTrees.com. And in this broadcast, Matthew Shipp, Harold Budd, and Corey Wallace. Vital Weekly comes up at 2 p.m., assembled by the Vital Weekly email magazine. Excerpts from the best new experimental music in the world. And then at 6 p.m., live from the City of Hudson, the Hudson Budget Public Hearing. WGXC is partnering with the City of Hudson to present a live audio stream of public meetings. To view the full WGXC programming schedule, make a one-time donation, or become a sustaining donor, visit our website, WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Scout of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Antonio Delgado held his latest town hall meeting on Saturday, November 16th at Copaig's Town Hall. Had a live web stream and live broadcast on WGXC. Here is an excerpt.
Yes.
I watched the hearings this week, and it really struck hard hearing them talk about how the whistleblower identity needs to come out. And this, I'm hearing this at the same time that I'm hearing news about the shooting in Southern California, and they're talking about how people need to contact when they see concerning behaviors, and you talked about universal background checks, and there's mandated reporting for like abuses, so it's very alarming to hear that people are really pushing to know who reporters are, and how can we stop that?
Well, I mean, I think that we have to protect whistleblowers at all, always. There's a role there. It's a critical role to make sure that we enable the truth, an opportunity, and then you can investigate from there. You don't know what to investigate. You don't know what to pursue if you don't have folks who are willing to ring the alarm from their vantage point. Doesn't mean that when they ring the alarm, that that was on its face the truth. But for someone to be in that position, it's important because typically those are the individuals who have visibility into things that no one else does. None of us do. So there's a sense that if you take that away from folks, if you take away the power of individuals in these situations who feel like they have to let something out to the public, they feel responsibility, but also are worried, but in doing so, they will be harmed. Their families might be harmed. There has to be protections for that. In a democracy in particular, in a free society in particular, you've got to create windows for truth, or for the, at least the potential to investigate an allegation of corruption, right? If we're gonna allow that to happen, we gotta make sure that we have points for that to happen. And I get gravely concerned, when our elected officials would rather politicize that dynamic for their own benefit. It doesn't matter if this individual or whistleblower is for you or against you, that's separate and apart. If at the end of the day, the facts or the allegations are laid on the table, now you investigate. Now you look into it and you see where the facts lead you. Doesn't mean that all of a sudden what was said was right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean you don't, you shut that person up or expose that person or vilify that person. You know, that's part of what it means to allow for free information, for us to make informed decisions. We can't short circuit that process. And that's a critical need. And I didn't talk about this in opening remarks, but listen, we have the inquiry that's going on right now. Mm-hmm. It is leading, in my estimation, to some critical facts being revealed. And these facts continue to be alarming for me. And I think, you know, as I said, and for those who follow me closely on this issue, I was not one of those members of Congress who came out early on this issue. I was trying to do this in a way where we could pursue truth, pursue understanding what's going on, particularly as it pertained to Russia's meddling, in a fashion that would be as nonpartisan as possible. And I believe then, and I believe now, that when you implement certain tools, they have the tendency and they have the ability to really politicize something, even if that is not your intent. And we are already a divided country. And I had this fear and notion that we were going to make it more divisive if we did this. That being said, things changed when, in my estimation, the president for the first time admitted, in essence, to some wrongdoing. When you admit to seeking political favor from a foreign national, there's not much room at that point. There's just not a lot of room for debate. You know, there's no room to say, oh, well, maybe the facts will lead to some other point. He's already said this would happen. And so now it's about understanding, well, why? For what purpose? Was money withheld? Who was put in harm's way? How many people were fired and removed as a result of this? How long did this date back to? And how much was the power of the presidency used for this personal political purpose? All of that is important to get to the bottom of, in my estimation. And you try to do that in the most nonpartisan way possible, but it's hard to do that in the partisan world we live in today. Yes?
Yes, okay, you're speaking about truth, okay? Okay, let's get all of the truth out. Let's investigate the Bidens.
Oh my God.
Let's investigate Hillary Clinton. Hold on. Oh, yeah. Let's investigate Hillary Clinton's email scandals. Let's investigate.
Wait. Come on now. Calm down. Go ahead, sir.
That's it. Let's investigate the whole thing.
Yeah, what's your question? You're supposed to have a question.
When are we going to investigate them?
So I would just say, first, I just want to say this. We got to be respectful.
Yeah.
We got to be respectful. You know, people have different points of views. It happens in democracy. You know, particularly for my progressive friends, we really take pride in our diversity. Diversity is also political points of view. There will be different points of view. Everybody has different walks of life, different experiences, and it's up to us to figure out how to hear each other out. We disagree. There actually has been an investigation. They just closed the books on the investigation into Hillary Clinton. They just closed the books, and they just made the findings. And there were no corruption. The Biden dynamic you speak of, if I'm not mistaken, that's what you're referring to. The facts have made it clear, and if you go back and look at this, Biden was one of a host of world leaders who came out and stood up and said that the administration of the regime in Ukraine was corrupted, and that the prosecutor on the case was not doing right by his citizens or fellow citizens. That individual wasn't even conducting an investigation into the company that now people say should be investigated. The individual who replaced him actually did do the investigation. So Biden's demand to ultimately remove this individual led to the very investigation that people are claiming he didn't want to happen in the first place. But his own actions led to it. And then ultimately that investigation concluded there was no trouble, no corruption. So these are just the findings, these are just the facts. And I try to deal in a world where we have to focus on what the facts are. And we have a lot of opinions. A lot of people have a lot of opinions, a lot of them. But those opinions aren't facts. And if we're gonna have a conversation, if we're gonna have a conversation about these things, which are, these are testy issues, there's no doubt about it. We've gotta be able to say, okay, let's be disciplined enough to focus on what we know. What do we know? What do we not know? And then we can try to move from there. That doesn't promise us a clean conversation in every instance, but it at least gives us a chance to get through a conversation in a way where we're finding, at least it's agreeable, at least where we've set the table in a way where we have an ability to talk to each other without yelling, screaming.
You know, it's not as much fun to write political songs anymore.
Stop knowing.
It's going to stop going so crazy. You just don't want to sing about it. But they did say that Mussolini said the best way to kill a chicken is to pluck it one feather at a time. Hop in the truck, let's go to Hudson. Just to check the sights and see. People here from the city and their newest gadgetries. Guys are scrolling on their iPhones. Ladies strolling down the street. Wonder Bar for beer and whiskey. Work our way down Warren Street. Spotty dogs at books and art supplies. I'm reading, drinking at the bar. Drinking pints, I'm kind of hammered. I left the place to find your car. Later on, we're at Hilo. Later on, I'm at the Red Dot. Elbow my way up to the bar. Cassandra made me something special. Can't seem to make this whole thing start. Later on, I'm at the Red Dot. Elbow my way up to the bar. Cassandra made me something special. Can't seem to make this whole thing start. Now we're out laughing in the alleys. Guess we are just who we are. We trip, we slip, we fall, we stumble. Don't know why, but here we are. Now we're out laughing in the alleys. I guess we are just who we are. We trip, we slip, we fall, we stumble. Drop out from the stars. We're out laughing in the alleys. I guess we are just who we are. We trip, we slip, we fall, we stumble. Don't know why, but here we are. Thank you.
That was local artist Chris Neumann performing at Hilo in Catskill on February 2nd, 2019.
From 2018, Ross Goldstein from Catskill released the Eighth House record. This is Notes from the Village.
Hi, I'm Laura from Hudson at the Hudson Farmers Market. You're listening to WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM hands-on radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Dan from the Battlefield Earth Program. Have you donated yet to the radio station WGXC? Well, it's as easy as going to WGXC.org and hitting the donate button. It's like picking a chocolate out of a baby's hair. Please remember, we need you so that you can need us. WGXE.org.
WGXE underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Lennox Local in Lennox, Massachusetts. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC. Like good old tap water. Just turn it on and get it.
And so I'm very pleased to welcome to the Grassroots Radio Conference and to Rochester, New York, Mr. Glenn Ford.
Power to the people. I want to talk to you very seriously about black radio news. And that is the door that I walked through about half a century ago. Black radio news was once a very powerful tool that, if wielded correctly, could function as both a magnifier and an incubator of grassroots political movements. In fact, black radio news was birthed by the black mass movement of the 60s. It is a child of that movement and cannot be understood outside of that movement. And when the movement died, black radio news almost died with it. Black radio news did not exist as a national force and a national institution before the great mass movement of the 60s. And it faded and went damn near extinct following the dismantling of that black mass movement. Black radio news is therefore inseparable from the fortunes of the black mass movement, the movement that brought it into existence. What is the power of news? It's a very basic question, but I want to ask it of you. You guys are involved in the dissemination of information. So what is the power of news? The news person acting as an editor, and every news person acts as an editor of a kind, decides what is important among the many events of the day. and he or she decides who are the most relevant people and the most relevant institutions to discuss those events of the day. News people decide who the credible sources are who are going to interpret these events of the day. News people decide who the key players are in the political arena, and they decide that by repeatedly calling on these particular players for comments about and in the news. That means that news people decide who the leaders of society are, because if someone is constantly called upon and put into the news, then the people assume that those people must be the leaders of something. It goes with the game. Now, of course, if you are reading somebody else's copy, if you are playing some corporate news feed, then you are allowing other people to decide what the issues and events that are most important are and who is qualified to speak on those issues and to comment on those events. Therefore, you are allowing those other people, those corporate news feeders, for example, to decide who the leaders of society are. When I first started talking on the radio, that's what I used to call it, full-time news people only existed at a very, very few black-oriented radio stations, and those stations were located only in the very big markets. Most of the people who were called news people, even at those big markets, actually were just reading wire copy from United Press International and from the Associated Press. Some students of black radio say that by about the year 1958, there were 50 or 60 black radio stations. That is, radio stations whose programming was dedicated exclusively to the black audience. This has nothing to do with ownership. We're talking about black programming. In 1958, my father, his name was Rudy Rutherford, he called himself the Deuce, he was on the air for half an hour every night, starting at 10:30 on radio station WNJR in Newark, New Jersey. He wasn't on the staff of that station. He had a day job. Back in those days, it was very common if someone could sell enough airtime to fill a broadcast slot, they could go on and be the announcer during that airtime. As long as they brought in the commercials, they could be in radio, but not necessarily on staff. So my father would hustle used car dealers and nightclubs in Newark and around northern New Jersey to get enough commercial time so he could be Rudy Rutherford, the radio announcer, for a half hour at 10:30 at night. The station did, of course, have announcers on staff, but only two of them were black. All the rest of the announcers were white. They had names like Sweet Daddy Santucci and Music Man Imperatelli, but they played black music, and of course they played jazz. So my father got frustrated after a while, selling all that airtime to used car dealers and only getting about half an hour, and he left northern New Jersey, and he went back home to his hometown of Columbus, Georgia. And immediately upon returning to Columbus, Georgia, he found work at the local black radio station. He also took his two sons down to Columbus, Georgia with him, so I got to observe all this stuff. When he went down to Georgia, he stole the radio persona of one of the greatest black disc jockeys of all time. This man should be on the Mount Rushmore of black radio. And his name was Jocko Henderson. He was hailing from Philadelphia, but at one time he was on the air live every day from Philadelphia and then from New York City. And he then got airtime to establish the first black dance show on television out of New York City. And at the same time that he was doing all of that, he was also on the air in Boston and St. Louis and in Detroit and in Miami. Jocko Henderson was like a one-man syndication. As I said, he was the greatest black disc jockey of all time. So if my father had to steal somebody's persona, that was the man to steal it from. And as soon as he got that job at the local radio station in Columbus, Georgia, he went to the local television station and proposed, just like Jocko, a dance show. And they went for the idea. And my father became the first black person in the country to have a non-gospel show in the Deep South because of that. They put the show on at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm sure that some people at the radio station assumed that nobody would show up that early on a Saturday morning just to dance for an hour. But they were wrong. The young folks came from literally 100-mile radius. They came from down in to the south in Florida. They came from the west, almost as far as Montgomery, Alabama, and from the east as far as Macon, Georgia, and from the outskirts of Atlanta to the north. And they would load up on buses at midnight, because this was before the interstate, and spend hours on winding country roads just to get there at 6 o'clock in the morning to be on that show, Rocking with the Deuce. They rode through the night as if it was a freedom ride, and I guess to many of them, it felt like that. And for establishing that program, my father got put in the Black Radio Hall of Fame. Now, I was watching all that just as his son. It wasn't all that exciting to me, but I used to hang around the radio station a lot because there's not much to do other than that in Columbus, Georgia. And my father would coerce and bully me into going on the air. Obviously, he wanted to produce another chip off the old block, but I didn't mind doing that, and I was bored anyway. And his listeners would call up and say, you know, Deuce, your daughter sure can read that news. Because my voice hadn't changed. But when I went on the air reading the news on these hourly 5-minute broadcasts, I read my own copy. I didn't read the AP wire copy because I left a little bit out of the story. My mother and father met in the Communist Party. I'm a red diaper baby. I got my history from Herbert Aptheker's multi-volume History of the Negro in the United States and from Lerone Bennett's voluminous writings on the subject, and not just on Black America, but on the condition of the world. And so I knew that the Associated Press and UPI and all of them were lying. And so I did a rewrite of the UPI copy every day. I didn't consider at that time, I had no ambitions to be in radio because there was no prospect at that time from my vantage point in Columbus, Georgia, that there would ever be a market for black radio news or for radio news on black radio, because it virtually did not exist. And it must be said at this point that there was not yet a mass demand for black news on black radio. And so the disc jockeys read the wire copy. And sometimes it was quite funny because many of these wonderful jocks who were very good with the patter could not read. I remember one of them who had great problems manipulating his mouth among words of more than a couple of syllables, who would just stop in the middle of reading the news and say, big word, and then... and then move on. Now, in 1958, when my father got back to Georgia, and in 1961, when as an 11-year-old I started reading the news, there had already been, of course, ongoing civil rights movement activity. There were lunch counter sit-ins and all kinds of direct action experiments trying to figure out how we're going to upset this Jim Crow. But there was not, at that time, anything that we could call a mass movement. This was 2 years before the 63 March on Washington. It was 4 years before black folks really kicked it off by burning down the Watts section of Los Angeles in 1965. So the civil rights movement, the black movement wave, had not hit. But when it did hit around 1965, it felt like a wave of consciousness, a wave that roiled people. And once black folks started shaking up the country and scaring white people and shouting down the man and arguing very loudly and publicly among themselves about something that they were calling liberation, using that word to accent the purpose of the movement, accompanying that was a demand for news. We must remember that in the year 1965, there were 10,000 separate demonstrations. Those people, the public at large, whether they were involved in these demonstrations or not, wanted to hear about them. They were demanding news. I'm talking about black people demanding news from the stations that they listened to. And they wanted to hear that news from other black people because that was the only source that they were going to trust during this period of mass movement activity. The demand for black-oriented radio itself, I'm not just talking about black news, but the demand for more black radio stations also exploded with the explosion of the movement. Researchers estimate that by about 1966, there were about 100 black radio stations. My research says that there were probably about 120 by that time, which is twice as many as in the early 60s. By the time I got out of the Army in 1970, I estimate that there were at least 180 black-oriented radio stations. That phenomenal growth was directly related. It was, in fact, caused by the mass movement that had marked the 1960s. And white money, investor money, responded to that movement by purchasing, establishing rather, black radio stations. This, again, was not a phenomenon of black ownership. James Brown in 1970 was the radio station king. He had more radio stations than any other black person. Three, one in Augusta, one in Knoxville, Tennessee, and one in Baltimore. And the Baltimore station was just a daytimer. But that was all. This phenomenon of the explosion of black radio was a white investor and black mass of folk affair. Virtually every top 50 black radio market had at least one black radio station, and many had several. But even small but heavily black cities and towns were likely to have a radio station, and if there was a radio station there, it was likely that they had a full-time newsman. For example, even a small town like Sparta, Georgia, which is the county seat of Hancock County, deep in the Black Belt, a very rural county, they had a full-time news reporter at the radio station. All of this had happened so quickly, just as the 60s movement seemed to happen so quickly itself. At the beginning of the decade, we saw a configuration that changed utterly by the end of the decade. All of a sudden, there was an institution, Black Radio News, that had not even existed before the advent of the mass movement. And so there were suddenly hundreds of young people who were acting as journalists on radio. And although not all of them were radical like me, many of them were. And there was a culture, maybe it was a subculture, in Black Radio News of purposeful and very conscious radicality, that we were spreading information for liberation. And nobody was there with some kind of textbook to describe what Black news is. And so we wrote that book ourselves. We decided how a Black person in this new age was supposed to comport themselves on radio as a journalist. We wrote those rules. And we, for a time, had the right, the privilege, the liberty, the license to write those rules because we had a movement behind us that had called upon us to do this kind of work. The fuel that powered this explosion of Black radio news was the mass Black demand that the media that played our music and that employed those disc jockeys that spoke our language would also report on the Black condition, locally as well as nationally and globally. Black people were voracious for information about themselves and about their communities, almost as if they had just discovered themselves. But of course, that is what real movements do. They change people through collective struggle. And folks that have been changed through movement work, through collective struggle, these newly Black and proud, as James Brown said, people were deeply curious about their new selves. It was like they were looking in the mirror every day, but that mirror was this new media that they had called into existence. And that's why they demanded Black news. This was the heyday of Black radio news. You never know that you are in a heyday until it's gone. But 1970 and the next 5 years or so would be the apex of Black journalism, journalism on a medium that actually reached almost all of the Black population. And that is also unique. The growth of Black radio during the decade of the 60s had filled in virtually all of the spots on the Black map. Everybody virtually had access to Black radio, and as I said, almost all of those radio stations had news. They were all covered by a Black signal. Black radio, despite being mostly white-owned, had become a truly national Black communications medium that reached almost every Black American in the country. And most of those stations provided news of and by Black Americans. Not only was Black radio pervasive, no other demographic came close then or now to matching Black listener loyalty to Black radio. That is, Black people listen to their radio more than any demographic listens to the radio that tries to serve them. This is an historic reality, and it continues, even though overall listening to radio has declined with the proliferation of all these other platforms. Now, and that's why this may sound strange, because there are so many reasons not to listen to radio, so many other things to do. But back to the period that we're examining, in the early 70s, 90% of the black population listened to the local black station. And that made these stations very, very attractive to investors. Advertisers were still blatantly discriminating against black radio. There was, in effect, what was casually called the 20% discount. That is, advertisers knew that they could look at the quoted rate of a spot on black radio and discount it 20% because the audience was black. And they got away with that. But still, because black listeners were so, and remain, so loyal to black radio, and there were so many non-black stations in any given market, black radio stations served a disproportionately large segment of the market. So they were in a strategically good position, although they were cheated every day by advertisers of a good rate. Before there was hip-hop, young people and older people listened to the same station, and the only outlier was the God people, and they'd listen to the local gospel station. And that made the black radio station even more important, especially politically, in that the young folks who are the most volatile politically, and the older folks who actually vote, were listening to the same messages. So the political importance of these black radio stations was really immense. Black radio's audience was the whole community, and the whole community wanted their reporters, the ones they heard every day, to reveal to them who was on their side in struggle and who was worthy of support. So when I got my first salaried job after leaving the Army, and that was again in January 1970 at James Brown's radio station in Augusta, Georgia, there was no question that my mission was to shake up that city thoroughly. But also I didn't have any idea how I was going to do that because that was my first job. I did know something, and that was that Augusta was a backwater. I knew that because Columbus, Georgia was very much like it. It's on the other side of the state. It was a backwater too. The mass movement of the 60s had hardly touched Augusta, Georgia, and it hadn't touched Columbus, Georgia either. Although people there had vicariously experienced the movement through the media. Augusta was a half-black city, but it didn't even have one black city councilman. It was very much like Columbus, Georgia, where Rudy the Deuce was still on the air. These were the cities, along with Macon, along with Savannah. These were the cities that Dr. Martin Luther King had been prevented from coming into by the local racist power structure, backed up by the black clergy. What folks, most people don't understand is that although the SCLC was considered a rump renegade section of the black clergy, Dr. King still adhered to the protocols of good Baptists. And he would not go into a city unless there was an invitation from another minister. You didn't just roll into a city uninvited and set up shop. But the fact was that throughout Georgia, and in fact throughout the South, most cities, ministers were adamant that Dr. King not come in. Their attitude was, we can handle our relations with the white folk. We don't need any outside people coming in here and roiling things up. The fact of the matter is that the preaching class had been collaborating with the white power structure all along. And so when you study up on Dr. King, you will see that his itinerary was actually dictated by those few places in which he could gain entrance because of an invitation. And in Georgia, that was just in the smaller city of Albany, because some preachers were fighting among themselves. And as part of their fight, one of them called in Dr. King. And then they hooked up with the students at the Black College.